Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with special guest appearances from my cat Chicken and the wild parrots next door. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. Today, I'm very excited to have writer, director, actor, Isabel Sandoval. Hi!
Hi, April. Thank you so much for having me on.
Lovely to see you. For those of you who would like a little refresher on Isabel's career, let me give this to you now. Isabel is a Filipino US-based filmmaker who has written and directed three features. Her first, Senorita, debuted in 2011, competing at the Locarno Film Festival, and followed the story of Donna, a trans sex worker who gets the chance to leave that life behind with a job caring for her friend's child. Only, when Donna arrives at her new gig, she finds that her old life has followed her unexpectedly and in devastating ways. From there, Isabel directed Apparition in 2012, about a cloister of reclusive nuns in the Philippines, whose search for peace is put to the test when President Marcos declares martial law. That film competed in the New Current section at the Busan International Film Festival and is seen as a modern classic alongside the works of other Filipino filmmakers like Lav Diaz and Briante Mendoza. Now, Isabel's third feature is called Lingua Franca, co-starring Iman Farron and telling the story of sexual awakening and empowerment through a young immigrant caregiver in Brighton Beach whose quest to get a green card is put in peril when she falls for the wrong type of man. The film has played at festivals around the world but premiered at Venice, making Isabel the first trans woman director to compete there. Groundbreaking. Yay! So Ava DuVernay's Array is releasing that film, and it's available to watch on Netflix in the U.S. Isabel's currently developing her fourth feature, Tropical Gothic, a 16th century surrealist drama about the haunting of a Spanish conquistador. And in September, Indiana University will present an early career retrospective of Isabel's work as part of the Jorgensen Guest Filmmaker Series. So you've been busy. Isabel, I can see some kinds of parallels between you and the filmmaker, whose movie you chose today. But I'll tell you guys that the movie you chose to talk about today is Double Indemnity. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your favorite genre films?
So Double Indemnity is really just Wilder's third film, but he approaches it with, such confidence and flair. And at that point, noir was pretty young as a genre in American cinema, but it feels like as he executed it, the genre feels like a slick, well-oiled machine in a way, just because I feel like for the first time, the tropes and the elements that make noir the genre that it is come together, but also in a way that feels very smart and savvy and clever. And one thing that I also really like about Double Indemnity is that it locates its emotional center in quite an unconventional relationship in the film, which I thought was pretty risque, maybe, or maybe not risque, but it's between two men.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is...
we'll talk about it in the film too, just like the capstone, like the ending of this movie is just you realize the love that is there and
exactly.
What the story is actually trying to tell. And it's something that a lot of people will say that this movie marks the first actual real film noir movie. And it's a thing where a lot of people think that immigrants to the U.S. really made film noir. But the thing is that the vast majority of film noir was actually made by, non-immigrant Americans. It's just that the immigrants who made those
totally.
Entries were the ones, like some of them are the ones that really stood out and kind of took it to a next level. Sometimes you see that in terms of, like spaghetti westerns, if we're talking about
Sergio Leone.
Exactly. People who aren't even immigrants, but people who are just like outside of the U.S. That's all wonderful. We're going to get into all of that. But for those of you who haven't seen Double Indemnity, today's episode will give you some spoilers that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. you would like to pause and watch Double Indemnity, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Double Indemnity with a quick synopsis. Written by Raymond Chandler and Billy Wilder, and based on a novel by, or a story by, James N. King, and directed by Wilder for release in 1944, Double Indemnity stars Fred McMurray as insurance salesman Walter Neff. We meet him as he records a confession to his friend and mentor, Barton Keyes.
I killed Dietrichson. Me, Walter Neff. Insurance salesman. 35 years old, unmarried, no visible scars. Until a while ago, that is. Yes, I killed him. I killed him for money. And for a woman. And I didn't get the money, and I didn't get the woman.
Neff goes out to a house, and there's, you know, we travel back in time. Neff goes out to a house to remind a rich guy to renew his auto insurance, but he meets the guy's younger, beautiful wife instead. Phyllis Dietrichson, played by Barbara Stanwyck, almost immediately questions Neff about taking out an insurance policy on her husband without his knowledge.
Could I get an accident policy for him without bothering him at all?
How's that again?
It would make it easier for you, too. You wouldn't even have to talk to him. I have a little allowance of my own. I could pay for it, and he needn't know anything about it.
Why shouldn't he know?
Because he doesn't want accident insurance. He's superstitious about it.
A lot of people are. It's funny, isn't it?
If there was a way to get it like that, all the worry would be over.
Neff knows exactly what she means, and he's not interested. Then he decides he is. Only now he's got it worked out with the double indemnity clause, which would pay out double if the death is an accident.
There's a clause in every accident policy, a little thing called double indemnity. The insurance companies put in a sort of a come-on for the customers. That means they pay double on certain accidents, the kind that almost never happen. Like, for instance, if a guy is killed on the train, they pay $100,000 instead of $50,000.
I see.
We're hitting it for the limit, baby. That's why it's got to be the train.
Phyllis takes her husband to the train station, and Neff hides in the back seat and kills him. Then he gets on the train with Dietrichson's ticket, jumps off at the back, and pulls the guy's body onto the tracks to make it seem like an accident. All seems well and good, but Keyes' gut tells him that Phyllis killed her husband, probably with an accomplice, to collect on the policy.
Walter, I had dinner 2 hours ago, and it's stuck halfway.
Little man of yours is acting up again, eh?
There's something wrong with the Dietrichson case.
Why, because he didn't file a claim? Maybe he just didn't have time.
Maybe he just didn't know that he was insured.
He tells this to Neff while Phyllis even hides behind a door, so things are kind of closing in on this couple. It didn't work out how they wanted it to. Neff talks to Phyllis's beautiful virginal stepdaughter, Lola, who tells him she thinks Phyllis did it and that she probably killed her mother, whom Phyllis had once been a caregiver to.
Do you know who that nurse was?
No, who?
Phyllis. I tried to tell my father, but I was just a kid then. He wouldn't listen to me. 6 months later, she married him, and I kind of talked myself out of the idea she could have done anything like that. But now it's all back again. Now that something's happened to my father, too.
Two serendipitous things then happen. Keyes has a witness who says the man on the train was younger than Dietrichson. And Lola tells Neff that her boyfriend, Nino, has also been having an affair with Phyllis. Bingo. Neff goes to Phyllis, says he's going to pin it on her and Nino.
What do you think's going to happen to you? You helped him do the murder, didn't you? That's what Keyes thinks, and what's good enough for Keyes is good enough for me.
Maybe it's not good enough for me, Walter. Maybe I don't go for the idea. Maybe I'd rather talk.
Sometimes people are where they can't talk. Under 6 feet of dirt, maybe.
She shoots him in the shoulder, but can't kill him. He grabs the gun and kills her. Neff warns Nino not to go see Phyllis, thereby saving him. Then he goes to his office to record that confession we started hearing at the beginning of the film. Keyes overhears it. Neff tries to leave to flee to Mexico, but collapses from his gunshot wound.
You know why you couldn't figure this one, Keyes? I'll tell you. Because the guy you were looking for was too close. Right across the desk from you.
Closer than that, Walter.
I love you too.
Keyes then lights Neff's cigarette for him, an act of mercy and love as the sirens grow nearer. And that's the movie. I want to get into some of the things about this movie, it is an adaptation, but it's a very, in some ways, a loose adaptation of this. And also Chandler had not really worked in film. Raymond Chandler was like known for kind of like the pulpy noir stuff, but had not worked in film. It just wasn't big yet there. But there's something that Billy Wilder figured out in this film, that certain things can look wonderful on the page, but will not be photographable. And he said, quote, "Paramount bought Double Indemnity, and I was eager to work with Kane, but he was tied up working on a picture at Fox called Western Union. A producer friend, Joe Sistrom, brought me some Chandler stories from The Black Mask. You could see the man had a wonderful eye. I remember two lines from those stories especially. Nothing is emptier than an empty swimming pool. The other is when Marlowe goes to Pasadena in the middle of the summer and drops in on a very old man who is sitting in a greenhouse covered in blankets. He says, out of his ears grew hair long enough to catch a moth. A great eye he had, but then you don't know if that will work in pictures because the details in writing have to be photographable," end quote. And as a writer yourself, I mean, there have to be times where you're tempted to put in these like really poetic flourishes, but there's not a way that you can always photograph them.
In my own movie, though, should I talk about my movie?
Yeah, definitely. That's why you're here.
Yeah. There are actually, you know, certain sequences like a love letter being read by Alex, the male character, and that... Mm-hmm. The scene dissolves into like a fantasy sensual scene where Olivia, the trans woman character, is or maybe pleasuring herself mm-hmm. as she's listening to the words. And yeah, I think I've also feel like I'm becoming really more visual. The more movies I make, I feel like the less I rely on dialogue, or if I use dialogue, I employ dialogue to obfuscate the character's real intentions, which is, I think, pretty typical of noir. These very shady characters who are duplicitous and very devious, you know, which is, you know, represented very much by Phyllis Dietrichson.
I think something that I've heard from a lot of filmmakers too is just that their actual writing process does change the longer that they've been filmmaking, you know. And you said before, Billy Wilder, this was his third film. This was, and he was known for doing comedies before this.
My process is, I feel like I have two versions of the script. One is my version as a director. Mm-hmm. That's usually less than 90 pages. And then there's also kind of the official version that we show potential investors and financiers. That's between 90 to 120 pages, because that's the length of a typical script. Mm-hmm. And in terms of my process, I feel like...
We should back up, because I think that people would probably want to know what is in that extra like 20 pages that you might add on that you'd want to show a financier.
Just dialogue. Mostly dialogue, where characters, there might be a little more exposition. My films tend to be quite sparse when it comes to like explaining things and what's going on to viewers. I let my viewers meet me halfway and kind of fill in the blanks in mm-hmm. certain ways narratively, because I think that's more interesting and that makes your viewers more invested mm-hmm. in the story. Dramatically, so it's really more dialogue. And I find that when I'm on set and I'm rehearsing the scenes between actors, I think actors' faces can be so expressive that words become superfluous in certain scenes. Yeah. And that's the kind of cinema, I guess, that I wanna make, where characters' faces can be so captivating and intriguing. Because that's what cinema is about, like looking at faces, I feel.
And okay, so you mentioned a few things that I want to get back to, because I'm curious about this. The fact that we've got voiceover narration for this story, which a lot of people, you know, in their careers are warned away to do. They're like, don't do this because it's, you know, it feels tacky or cheesy or something. But, you know, and actually Billy Wilder felt the same, but he used it, and he was very specific about how he used it. He said, quote, "I have always been a great man for narration, and not because it is a lazy man's crutch. That is maybe true, but it is not easy to have good narration done well. What I had in Sunset Boulevard, for instance, the narrator being a dead man, was economical storytelling. You can say in two lines something that would take 20 minutes to dramatize, to show, and to photograph. There are a lot of guys who try narration, but they don't quite know the technique. Most of the time, the mistake is that they are telling you something in narration that you already see, that is self-evident. But if it adds, if it brings in something new, another perspective, then good," end quote. And, you know, I think that it works in both Sunset Boulevard and this, and it is economical storytelling. It is like the easiest way, and I don't notice it in a way that sometimes I notice narration in a movie, because it it is, you know, describing what we see.
Exactly.
And redundant.
Yeah. And I feel like here in Double Indemnity, like, the narration works because it's not, like you said, you know, telling us what the film is already showing, but it's immersing us into a tone and an atmosphere and a world. And even myself, for the longest time, I've always had an ambivalent relationship with narration and voiceover, because I feel like it's lazy storytelling. But then I realized I'm doing it in my own film, but I'm also doing it in a very unique way, that the movie opens and closes with a voiceover of my character. It's either, you know, a phone call between myself and my mother, and it's usually a conversation between two characters. And when it's transposed over an image, that's totally different. Like, halfway through the film, there is extreme wide shot of my character on an elevated subway, and the camera slowly zooms in. And what you hear is the pillow talk, essentially, between my character and the slaughterhouse worker. And it makes the conversation actually feel more intimate. And as it's closing, the shot is closing in, it also introduces a kind of anxiety and claustrophobia and paranoia. And I like the dissonance between that intimacy and the paranoia. Those are the tensions that excite me as a filmmaker.
Well, yeah, then I can see why you chose this film.
Yes.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more Double Indemnity, and also Lingua Franca movie, and all the rest of the films that Isabella Sandoval has made and is going to make. We'll be right back.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek?
Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about bugs.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too.
Butts, 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 butts.
No. Will you change your mind?
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Isabel Sandoval, and we're talking about Double Indemnity. So something that I love about this movie that I didn't really notice that I loved is something that Richard Schickel pointed out in the commentary as well. He said, quote, "One of the nice things about this movie is its judicious use of location shooting around Los Angeles. There's not a lot of it, but there's just enough to take it out of the studio context, give it the atmosphere of a city that is freer in its morality than the East. It's something Kane noticed and something Wilder noticed when he came to Los Angeles," end quote. So there's a few things happening here. And one of those is that I do love its location shooting, even though it's primarily shot in a studio soundstage. But there is just enough that it makes me feel like there are more locations than there actually are that are part of LA. And I, I love that. I'm a huge fan of like going out to locations and especially of classic films and visiting like the house, you know, from this movie. And then secondly, we're talking about two people, one an immigrant from outside of the U.S. and one a New Yorker who both come to Los Angeles. And again, the idea of outsiders realizing something kind of profound about the identity of a city, a place that they're not from, but they can kind of pinpoint what is different about it. And I love that aspect of it in both of those. I'm, you know, an Angeleno and I love it here. And, you know, any movie that can also poke fun at it in its immoral ways, it's wonderful too. But I think, you know, in Lingua Franca, I see that as well. I see a judicious use of locations that ground you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very important for me that the film had a really vivid and strong sense of place. And I feel like that's why also I said it in Brighton Beach, because it's not your, you know, predictable and generic New York type of movie. Mm-hmm. Especially in the outer boroughs like Brooklyn and Queens, where there are a lot of ethnic and immigrant neighborhoods, they each have their own distinct character and personality that's so different from Manhattan or even, you know, white hipster neighborhoods like Williamsburg. Like for me in my neighborhood, if I take the subway half an hour south to Brighton Beach, I feel like I'm whisked off not just to a different world, but to a different time. Like I feel like I'm back in the 50s and 60s in a way. And I wanted to show that in Lingua Franca. I wanted to open Lingua Franca with that kind of montage that just drops you into this strange world that still is part of New York City, and then have my character's voice over in Cebuano, which is my native dialect. Mm-hmm. And just kind of the juxtaposition of a place that is supposed to be America, but has its own foreign, distinct foreign flavor, and then this voiceover, which is another foreign culture.
One of the greater things that this movie did that differed from James N. Cain's book was that they didn't make Phyllis completely a psychopath, because they made her in the book was like very like chilling and just like insane. Right.
Oh, yeah.
But as Richard Schickel points out, they cleared that out and they simplified her. They made her less psychotically damaged in the movie. Instead, just a woman who was in it for the money, end quote. And that's it's a kind of, you know, like we're trying to relate characters. Like whenever you're trying to put something on the screen, you're trying to make some kind of character who's relatable, even if they're evil, if they do something else. And I think it would be too hard for someone to like stop and like relate to a woman, especially back in 1944 when this came in. I'm just like, I don't understand the psychotic woman, like what is happening. But to make someone who's just like in, you know, like post-depression period who like wants the money makes a lot of sense.
Although I think the one thing that I think could have been worked on in Double Indemnity is I feel like the femme fatale character, you know, Barbara Stanwyck, is really kind of a psychological cipher. She's really a textbook femme fatale with not much depth to her. And I think that's also the same way with Fred McMurray, Walter Neff, because how he decides to get involved in this crazy scheme, he sells it with a voiceover, essentially, like, oh, so this is how I got involved in this. And, but that, I guess that's the point of Wilder, in that it's not really about, you know, psychological depth or acuity, so to speak, but it's having a noir that's very stylish and with all these elements just coming together.
Yeah, there's a lot of smoldering scenes, and the characters always have chemistry. There's always something to say, and if there is nothing to say, then it's very, very pregnant pauses. and highly choreographed scenes. Like the one, for instance, where Phyllis is hiding behind the door and Keyes could come up and see her. And then Walter Neff has to like block him. And it's just like those scenes of tension. And that's an interesting thing too, that scene. I'll bring this up because then we can kind of get into like how we're shooting things, the technology. That was a deep focus scene, meaning that in Hollywood at that time, deep focus was very much a novelty. It was only used like in a few different movies, Citizen Kane most popularly. But it was primarily shallow focus that you were seeing in movies. And so having a deep focus scene like that, where you could see the relationship between bodies in a space with such a kind of like grand scale, it really opened up, I think, particularly film noir to even horror beyond it, of just this idea of tension between bodies. And I love that because then you get to use really wonderful choreography, like more inventive choreography of, you know, and you don't even, it can be a static shot, you know, it's the bodies moving makes the tension.
Yeah. I think before this, if I, you know, remember correctly, you know, film noir was not really taken seriously as a genre or as an artistic genre. It was something that, say, Warner Brothers did if they wanted to make something on the cheap, you know. So it was kind of like just hastily put, thrown together. And I think because of Double Indemnity and Wilder really putting it his distinctive stamp, and it turned out to be a critical and box office success, like they started seeing the possibility and potential for noir to be a serious artistic genre.
Yeah. I mean, that's the same way that I feel about horror, which I always feel like horror is kind of like a cousin of film noir in terms of like who's making horror films and how they're making them, because it's a place of innovation if you're doing it correctly, I think. And film noir we see with Billy Wilder, you know, I can see that in your film too. I can actually see there's a noir influence in, because like you're saying before, there's a kind of there's a stillness to the camera in what you're doing. So even though I wouldn't necessarily classify your film as a noir, I can feel that tinge deeply in its identity.
Definitely. And I feel like Senorita, my first film, is really a neo-noir. Anyway, both stylistically in terms of how it's, you know, lit and shot, but also because my main characters tend to be women with secrets.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the most quintessential noir element, I think. Like women with a dark,
it's the thing you have
shadowy
to have.
Past. Exactly. But, you know, how I kind of update and subvert noir in my own work is that the femme fatales are fully developed, complex, layered characters. They're not just there to seduce the guy and have him kill someone for money.
It's an interesting thing because, like, with a movie like Double Indemnity, I think in terms of what I've had to do my entire life of watching genre films is sometimes I project my own feelings onto women characters. I project them of what I think about them that isn't necessarily in the text or the subtext of the movie, but I'm like, oh, I love this character for her richness of this and this and this. But if I watch it, it's not there. It's what I'm putting onto her of, because she is, as you said, a cipher. And that allows me to kind of fill her with my own thoughts and feelings about her, where it's just like, I love Phyllis. Yeah. And I have a very specific idea of why I love Phyllis. It may not be in the movie, but that's open for interpretation because it's, you know, what I love. And now you have people who can be more, you know, with women behind the camera kind of being more explicit about feminine desire and greed and all of these other wonderful vices and virtues. So it's just a different era.
Yeah.
But, you know, you still have to have some, I mean, do you have a, is it tempting to make a man a cipher?
Anyway, that happens organically in my own work because I just do not understand the psychology of a man. Like my main characters, even before I transitioned, my main protagonists have always been women. That's just how I think and feel and write characters in my work, the women are developed. Yeah. Like in my second feature, Apparition, the one about the nuns, there are virtually zero men characters.
Yeah.
And if they are, and if they have lines, you can barely see them in the frame. So when I write, so like in Lingua Franca, when I was writing the scenes with just the men, like hanging, you know, shooting the shit, I asked my guy friends to read the dialogue mm-hmm. and see if it worked, if it sounded, if it rang true. Yeah, but I don't really care about the main characters in my movies. But my women are so, you know, they're multi-layered. You can peel so many layers and still not get to the bottom of what makes them tick.
I mean, as you see pretty clearly in Lingua Franca, which I think is kind of a study in seeing how little you can give and still know or don't, you know, like, think you know this character.
Yeah.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more Double Indemnity and Lingua Franca with Isabel Sandoval. We'll be right back.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Isabel Sandoval, and we're talking about Double Indemnity. So something that Billy Wilder said about screenwriting is, quote, "A screenwriter is a bum poet, a third-rate dramatist, a kind of half-assed engineer. You got to build that bridge so it will carry the traffic. Everything else, the acting, the drama, happens on the set. Screenwriting is a mixture of techniques and a little literary talent, sure, but also a sense of how to manage it so that they will not fall asleep. You can't bore the actors or the audience," end quote. That's kind of his guiding principle. It was just like, don't bore people. You know, if you've got to say exposition, say it in a really interesting way, you know?
Yeah, I think he is the perfect and ideal studio director, you know? You got to keep your audiences entertained. But what made Double Indemnity powerful for me was, just to allude to what I talked to in the beginning, was really how it gives an emotional gut punch in the end in the terms of relationship between the two main characters. And I'm wondering whether that was controversial at the time because, you know, it can be read as a little homoerotic.
But I think people back then just weren't even aware of, like, homoeroticism. Like, I think that they, like, they're just like, yeah, of course a man loves a man. But they, like, didn't get, like, what that meant. Or, you know, I think that, like, there was a kind of ignorance of that. And so, I'm fairly, a little familiar with Filipino filmmaking, contemporary Filipino filmmaking. And I think the way that your work sits in that kind of canon is very different.
Yes.
It is not a Briante Mendoza kind of, like, very in your face. I can still see naturalism there, you know, like, I think naturalism seems like a very Filipino concept.
Yes.
But
yeah, the sensibility is very different because I feel like with Briante Mendoza, his European counterpart may be like the Dardenne brothers, you know, it's a very gritty, handheld docudrama about people living in slums. I know that his like the current wave of Philippine cinema has been accused of, and I hate using this term, poverty porn.
But yeah,
you see kind of these people, you know, in misery. And I wanted to do something different. Although on paper, Lingua Franca sounds like a standard, you know, or textbook social issue drama, I did that deliberately so that I can then subvert people's expectations about the kind of movie that it will be. So it's a far more delicate, lyrical, sensual than that kind of film. And as a result, it's somewhat polarizing. The very first trade reviews about the film that came out after Venice were written by literally reviewers who said, oh, this should have been more like a Briante Mendoza movie.
It's the thing, like, you'd be like, I think that if you come from a specific culture, you're kind of standing in the shadow of giants. I think that you'll easily separate yourself from the pack. I wanted to get into some set anecdotes from Double Indemnity, see if you had any kind of parallels in your own career. There was Billy Wilder was very specific about the things that he wrote, the things that he shot. He really tried to never overshoot anything. You know, he knew that, like, the celluloid was, like, valuable, and he was just, like, very, again, economical about what he was doing. So it was very precise. But at the same time, he would still let inspiration strike him in the moment. And there is definitely one of those things within this. Richard Schickel said, quote, "They're not being able to start the car was the superb invention of Wilder's. He was shooting this scene on the soundstage," and he's talking about after they drag the body on and they try to make their getaway and they try to start the car and it won't. "He was shooting this scene on a soundstage, broke for lunch, and got in his car, and his car wouldn't start. He said, 'Oh my God, what a great thing. They're about to make their getaway and their car won't start.' He went running back to the soundstage, hoping they hadn't knocked down this mock-up automobile they had created, and they hadn't. He said, 'Hold it, we'll redo this scene this afternoon.' McMurray objected that nobody would believe it, but it works. It's like when the woman interrupted them in the market for the baby food. It locks them into the reality of the city they're in. It keeps the story grounded," end quote. So there's a few things on this of just like the allowing that inspiration to strike and then just kind of carrying it out. And people are like, "Oh, it's not on the script. I don't know." And he's just like, "Eh, I don't care." It's an extra beat of the story that kind of ratchets up the tension, and it feels miraculous. And so you go with it. I think it might be easier to do sometimes in an independent film set because you have a ragtag crew and you're just like, let's get it done. Oh my God, I can't believe the light looks like this. We should definitely catch the light, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, there's a scene in Lingua Franca where my character has an emotional breakdown, and we shot the entire scene in a single shot that moves from one end of the room to, you know, to the other. And my cinematographer was actually arguing with his crew because, and they were saying that you can't do this in like a studio production. And that's exactly, yeah. I mean, my DP said, exactly, that's why we're doing it here, because we can. And they weren't sure they could pull it off, but after like 45 minutes, an hour, they were able to set it up and we got the scene after three takes. And Lingua Franca was actually shot in just 16 days with all those locations. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you have to be, as an independent filmmaker, you have to be really on it. So even though I was also acting, I made sure that I knew what I was gonna do on set, you know, exactly the shots that I want. I have a very clear idea. When I conceive of my films, I conceive of them not as words on a page, but as actual shots and, you know, scenes cut together. And that's what helps me, so that I get into an argument with my DP, because he has also a very strong visual sense and he does amazing work in this film. But when I wrote the ending of Lingua Franca a certain way, which we cut out from the final cut, but the final shot supposedly of Lingua Franca was of my character walking out of the house, but it was shot from across the street, and I wrote it. But when I saw the footage, I thought it looked like shit. So we changed the framing of it a different way where you see it from the side, and that worked. It looked much better. So yeah, I am very intuitive. And that's why sometimes my DP and I get into argument, because he is very structured and he wants everything planned. And I'm the type that if I want to see first if it works, especially because sometimes we would get our locations not until the day before, like the slaughterhouse. We did not confirm that slaughterhouse until the day before we were supposed to shoot there.
Oh man, biting nails.
Yeah.
Because that's a big part.
Exactly. Like...
How do you, how would you recreate a slaughterhouse? You're just like, okay, we've got to get about 10 whole skinned cows hung up.
Yeah. And so on the day that we shot it, they were like, okay, you have 4 hours, do your thing. And we paid $10,000 for that slaughterhouse. And so we had to do everything.
Yeah.
In those
but you didn't
hours.
Have to dress it. I mean, it comes
exactly.
with the, came with the meat. That's a big benefit. I want to go back to the other part of this quote where Schickel is talking about that the woman in the market, because they always meet in that market, who interrupts them looking for baby food. And this kind of thing of just like creating tension between two characters and having this outside force kind of come in that like complicates things momentarily, even if it's just for something silly and stupid. And I love that kind of technique in screenwriting. And some people might think that and in some ways would be like, oh, that's like a mistake. Why just take it away? Like, we don't need that. We'll cut it first. But it's such a little thing that I adore about this movie, just like the small details of the outside world kind of butting into their plan and their plot.
It adds to the sense of realism in the film. And also, it's the dry humor.
It's such a strange thing. I mean, like that Billy Wilder, who, you know, obviously did comedies, and including The Apartment, such a big, big comedy movie. I just think you see that sensibility and the way that he's kind of structuring things. And, you know, something that he was talking about, you know, when this movie came out, because people just didn't understand why he was going to make this particular movie. And he just didn't think that it would be any different from what he did usually. He said, quote, "I don't make only one kind of movie, like say Hitchcock or like Minnelli doing the great Metro musicals. As a picture maker, and I think most of us are this way, I am not aware of patterns. We're not aware that this picture will be this genre. It comes naturally, just the way you do your handwriting. That's the way I look at it. That's the way I conceive it. When you see movies, you decide to put some kind of connective theory to them. You may ask me, do you remember that in a picture you wrote in 1935, the motive of a good guy was charity, and then the echo and that sentiment reappears in four more pictures, or you put the camera here. I'm totally unaware of it. I never think in those terms, the big overall theme of my oeuvre. You're trying to make as good and as entertaining a picture as you possibly can. If you have any kind of style, the discerning ones will detect it. I can always tell you a Hitchcock picture. I can tell you a King Vidor picture, a Capra picture. You develop a handwriting, but you don't do it consciously," end quote. You know, for someone like yourself who's doing both contemporary storytelling and a number of period pieces, I think that's an interesting thing to arrive at or to know about yourself as a filmmaker, that you're trying to bring that one kernel of who you are into every story that you tell, no matter what it is.
Exactly. And I think ultimately my goal is for my films to become their own genre, so to speak. When you think about it, a genre is really just a type of emotional sensibility in a film that is so strong and so affecting and also very popular that it becomes a formula, so to speak, and studios just want to replicate either that type of dramatic structure or that atmosphere because it transports you into a different world. And the most iconic auteurs and directors have become genres unto themselves. Like Wes Anderson is a genre. Let's be serious. Mm-hmm. Like you said, yeah. Tarantino.
Yeah, Charlie Kaufman is a genre. Yes. There's David Lynch is a genre. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Jarmusch is a genre, mm-hmm. very much so. And yeah, I want to have that develop my sensibility to that level, but also not put me in a box, so to speak. So even within within that genre, so to speak, I can still experiment and play, you know, with certain tones and with certain stories. Almodovar does it. And quite well, you know.
Well, I mean, you've got your work cut out for you, but you're well on your way, Isabel. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and for talking about this movie and your movie, Lingua Franca. And again, people can see that movie on Netflix right now. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, April. I had so much fun talking Double Indemnity.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Little man of yours is acting up again, eh?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.